Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 18th of October, 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish, and we're delighted to be joined by David Scott. Hopefully that live link will work. Well, the place to discover the news today is driving your car on the motorway. And we just thought we'd bring in this little sign. I apologise, it was raining. That's all due to climate change, of course. But here we are. Freight to EU papers may change 1st of November. Please check. But suddenly this sign has disappeared. So this morning when I came in, that was not the message on the big overhead gantry, Mike.
So the people that manage the road signs on the A38 know that this deal is going to be passed in Parliament tomorrow then, do they?
It looks like it. Yep. But here we are.
Well, let's get on to it. Here he is, Boris at the at the European Council yesterday, and it is a done deal. Apparently, Brexit without the exit is absolutely on the cards. Now, why are we saying that? We've been saying it for a number of years, but let's just remind ourselves that this deal is Theresa May's deal, and it is David Cameron's deal reformed. Now, his deal was based on the principle that we remain inside the EU, but we opt out of the institutions, the EU institutions that we don't want to be part of. Theresa May's deal was that we leave, but we opt back into the institutions that we don't want to be part of. Now, how do we know that this is what's going on? Well, let's have a look at the European Council's publication yesterday. The agreement reached at the level of negotiators, they said. The European Commission recommended that the European Council Article 50 endorse the revised withdrawal agreement, including a revised protocol on Ireland, Northern Ireland, and approve a revised political declaration on the framework of the future of the EU UK relationship. And you can see all the documents that they've published there. They've got a letter from Jean-Claude Juncker to President Donald Tusk. They've got revised text for the protocol on Ireland, Northern Ireland. They've got the revised political declaration. They've got a UK unilateral declaration on consent. We'll come on to that in a second. And they've got a European Commission press release. What they don't have is any kind of revised divorce deal. Right. So the only changes to the divorce deal are what's in the revised text for the protocol on Ireland, Northern Ireland. And actually, if you look at the content of the political declaration on the future relationship, the revised text of the political declaration setting out the framework for the future relationship between the European Union and the United Kingdom, as agreed by negotiators at negotiators level on 17th of October 2019, to replace the one published on the 19th of February 2019. You find that the only changes in this text are relating to the backstop. And in fact, it's more or less otherwise identical. The devil is in the detail, they say. But the only detail that's changed, as I say, is with respect to the backstop. And crucially, security and defence are untouched. And what's very interesting is that it seems like some of the campaigners, particularly William Prince, seem to be quite pleased with this current political declaration. They have said that they support this. And yet, up until this point, they have been campaigning against it. So we're very interested in that little development. But we come back onto this business of leave, but opt back into the institutions. Let's just listen from the horse's mouth to that.
We can also build now, after 3.5 years, we can build now on our relations with our friends and partners in the EU. And it will be a very exciting period now, as it were, to get to that, the positive side of that project. The extraction having been done, the building now begins.
So I don't know how it could be any clearer for people. The extraction having been done, the building now begins. We have left the European Union and now we're going to opt back in to all the institutions that we want to be part of, including security and defence. This was a stitch up from the beginning.
To build the future relation with the European Union. We're not leaving the European Union. We are building our future with the European Union.
Absolutely. David, let's bring you into the programme at this point. What are your thoughts so far?
Well, I've been trying to get a hold on what the changes are. And as you say, there really aren't any. It's the May deal with the Northern Irish mess improved.
We'll come on to that in a second about whether it is actually improved, but go on.
Okay. Changed.
Yes.
So, right. Okay. So what are we building? And this is the bit we've never really been able to get any clarity on. What are we building? Because take defence, for example. The political statement says that Britain retains its own strategic autonomy, which is good. But it also says we're going to be involved with the European Defence Fund and the whole raft of other parts of military union. Now, the whole point of that is to avoid duplication, waste, and build a single military. So there's a conflict there. So are we going to retain our own autonomy or not? And what it seems to me to give us is the opportunity to retain national sovereignty and military autonomy, strategic autonomy. But what vehicle are we going to use to do that? Well, the vehicle is a civil service that is surrendered to Europe many years ago, a government that seems unable to govern, and a House of Commons that's against the people. So the good thing about Brexit is it provides opportunities for independence that weren't there before. But what we then need is a means of seizing those opportunities. And right now, today, we don't have those.
Absolutely. Well, let's look at what this actually means then. So where does Boris's deal leave us? Well, apparently, we now have a significant border down the Irish Sea, which is something that Boris said would never happen. And of course, the DUP absolutely against that. We have a consent process, but it is a complex consent process. So apparently this means that we will not have an open-ended backstop anymore. We'll have a look at whether that's the case in 1 second. There's no veto for the DUP. Protects the all-Ireland economy. And I think, quite frankly, that what we're looking at here is the breakup of the United Kingdom. And I think that we're looking at a path towards a United Ireland at this point. But anyway, that's for further discussion. It does allow Britain to pursue trade deals elsewhere, if that's possible. And this comes back to my original point in 2016, that what this is about is one of the issues, aside from the defence issue that David has already covered, is the fact that TTIP failed as a policy, but they have not abandoned that policy. They still want to build that transatlantic trade and investment partnership. So this gives them the opportunity to do that in another guise. And finally, more permanent. Well, this is the key thing. This new situation is more permanent than the backstop, potentially. And so the question is, why would I say that? Because there's a complex consent process. And at the heart of the consent process is a Northern Ireland Assembly, which does not exist. It's closed for business. It's empty. It has ceased to be because 2 years ago, Sinn Féin withdrew from it as a result of a dirty deal that the DUP had initiated with respect to a green energy scheme, where basically people were being paid to heat empty buildings because the subsidy that was available to people was more valuable than the cost of the electricity. So the question is, will this deal bring the Northern Ireland Assembly back? Because if it doesn't bring the Northern Ireland Assembly back, then the whole consent issue is nonsense. It makes it means that every 4 years, getting consent from the Northern Ireland Assembly to continue the thing or to stop it can't happen. So, Sinn Féin this morning was saying this, there's no good Brexit, but this is better than no deal. What's been agreed is an avoidance of physical infrastructure on the island of Ireland, and there's going to be no unionist veto. So they're very pleased about that. But the bottom line here is, as I say, there is no Northern Ireland Assembly. There's no prospect of a Northern Ireland Assembly sitting for quite some time. And certainly there'd be no noises from Sinn Féin that I've heard to suggest that they would be coming back into government with the DUP anytime soon. So, David, this potentially leaves the backstop. And we should call it the backstop because, of course, this, what Boris has presented here, is effectively an earlier version of the backstop, which Donald Tusk had proposed a couple of years ago. So what this potentially does is leave us even more permanently in that situation than the backstop that we've rejected.
Yes, and Ireland once again becoming a political football. Many will have seen the heavily pushed by BBC and others real IRA video as balaclava clad alleged terrorist stated that all permanent infrastructure forming any sort of border or customs posts in Ireland would be legitimate targets. And we know what legitimate target used to mean, which used to mean absolutely everybody. And we're seeing, you raise the point of the failure of democracy in Ireland, in Northern Ireland, and the effects that that is having. But we're seeing broader failure of democracy all across Europe, very much centred in Westminster. And that vacuum cannot exist forever. Something is going to have to come in to fill it. And I fear that what will come will be able to make decisions much more rapidly and much more directly, but it may not be in anyone's interest. It may not be in the interest of people of Britain that entity comes in. We're seeing a failure of the democratic process to achieve anything worthwhile.
Can I just add a bit to that? We're seeing a failure, but I think what we've got to recognise is this whole situation is not accidental. This has been an engineered situation in politics. And let's remember, let's take the BBC just as a little thermometer of the temperature of events at the moment. The BBC a few months ago was putting out a programme which was about a civil war in UK as a result of Brexit. Let's not forget what was being pushed out. So as you pointed out, Mike, we can't have a democratic response, if you like, from Ireland, because that Northern Irish Assembly is not there. The EU would love to see the breakup of the relationship internally between Northern Ireland and we'll say England, because that is part of the EU's divide and rule policy. We've got the same agenda going on with Scotland. UK is under massive attack at the moment, and this hasn't just happened by accident. This has been engineered through the political parties, and the Labour Party, the Lib Dems, Conservatives, and we better add in the DUP and a few others have been part of this. This cannot be an accident, but we're in a very dangerous situation.
Now, tomorrow, of course, there's going to be a special session of Parliament, and well, the House of Commons is going to have its say on Boris Johnson's deal. One question is, are they going to force Boris to write a letter to the European Commission asking for an extension on Article 51? Well, Jean-Claude Juncker was pretty vociferous about this yesterday. He said, we've concluded a deal, and so there's not an argument for further delay. It has to be done now. However, of course, Jean-Claude Juncker is still, until the end of this month, European Commission President. Isn't it a coincidence that Britain is apparently leaving on the 31st of October, on the same day that Jean-Claude Juncker and Donald Tusk leave their jobs? Well, that may be a coincidence. But anyway, he said no argument for further delay. Well, Donald Tusk, on the other hand, said, if there's a request for an extension, I will consult the member states to see how to react. So he seemed to be hinting that there was some opportunity, some flexibility there. That remains to be seen. And whether Boris is forced to send this letter, of course, remains to be seen. At the moment, the mainstream press trying to get to grips with who's going to vote which way. Well, it looks like he may well get it through, although there's some opposition from the Labour Party and the Liberal Democrats. Certainly, the Labour Party does not seem to be enforcing a whip on this. And so it looks like people are free in the Labour Party to vote whichever way they feel like. Many of the rebels that have been temporarily thrown out of the Tory party seem to be saying that they will vote for Boris's deal. So he may well get it through. But in the meantime, David, we should introduce everybody to Joe Maugham QC. that's how you pronounce his name. He's the director of the Good Law Project. He's now taking, he's been taking a whole range of court cases over Brexit against the UK government. And he's now seeking an interdict from the Court of Session in Edinburgh to suspend Boris's deal on the basis that it breaks the Taxation Cross-Border Trade Act 2018, which states that it is unlawful for Her Majesty's government to enter into arrangements under which Northern Ireland forms a part of a separate customs territory to Great Britain. So he's attempting to take that to the Court of Session today, and again attempting to make sure that we are governed in this country by the courts rather than by government and parliament.
Yes, back to the Court of Session, and there's two cases going forward in the Court of Session. There's still this one where if Boris refuses to put in a request for an extension, having not got his deal through, the Court of Session will become Boris Johnson, will seize his legal personality and will put in the letter on his behalf. And the letter that was apparently written by a 12-year-old and is included in the Bend-Stroke-Surrender Act. But yes, we're seeing more and more the courts have been asked to govern in place of the government. And so this is the same man who was behind the previous case in the Court of Session with Joanne Cherry. The agenda here seems to be stop Brexit at all cost, because they want to remain in the union, and every act, every possible scheme will be deployed in order to prevent any form of Brexit for political reasons. So this is a political campaign being run through the courts. It's not a legal campaign, but of course it's using legal detail, which now runs to such a length, and there's so much on the statute book that no one can know at all. So there's a vast amount of opportunity to do things like this. And obviously we've also got the lack of any real leadership from the government. It's a void. We're not talking about independence. We're not talking about breaking away from the EU in any clear fashion. And that vacuum of where power is lacking will be filled by something.
Hilary Benn, who is, I'm not going to suggest for one second that I support in any way, shape or form, has been accused of producing the surrender bill. But this has got to be, Boris has got to be on the receiving end of similar types of rhetoric at the moment, because that's effectively what's happened here.
Yes, I mean, I think the fact that we are, that the courts can be used in this fashion, and that the current Boris Johnson policy is open to such challenge, is an indication of the weakness of the current Boris Johnson policy as much as anything else.
Yeah.
I've just found another bit, if I may, and that is you're talking about the space in politics. If we go back to the days when common purpose was just running rampant in UK, it still is to a certain extent, although it shifted a lot of its activity overseas. Part of their advertising rhetoric was that there was, quote, a space between ordinary people and the politicians, the political power base, and common purpose intended to fill that space. And the reason I bring that in is that if you look at how civil servants have been highly politicised and are clearly acting against the interests of the 17.4 million people that voted to leave, we can see that devious political charity has had a massive effect on control of people. They didn't make that statement by accident. So I think to hear you bringing that up, David, is very pertinent. There is a space, but unfortunately it's already been filled. And of course the objective is to make participatory democracy, where it won't be the ordinary voter that counts. It's going to be the government think tanks and the big foundations and the charities. But what can people do? Now, we know that a lot of people have followed up on our advice to be writing letters wherever possible. And we just wanted to start showing some of these letters. And I'm going to say we are very encouraged. If anybody thinks that a letter from a member of the public to an MP doesn't make a difference, it absolutely does. But this particular person decided to write to the British ambassador in Belgium. They live in the particular person lives in Belgium. And so here was the letter. Dear Mr. Shearman, status of the British military after Brexit. I'm not going to read all of this letter. Let's bring it on screen. But it says, as I understand it, there is at this stage a proposal to group together the existing militaries of the countries which are currently members of the European Union under a single point command and control and command to be administered by the EU. This entity is to be called the European Defence Force. I also understand that it's wrong terminology to refer it as the European Army or European military. And basically, the person is asking for the embassy to assist on this. The question I have for you is a simple one. Will Britain's military be committed to the European Defence Force after Brexit? Since your embassy is, to use an unfortunate expression, only a stone's throw from the European Union headquarters, I thought you might be in a position to provide a more authoritative answer. Now, in the first instance, of course, there was silence, no reply. And many people take this that the letter has had no effect. But I don't think that. What it tells us really is that the topic is too hot for the embassy. The embassy didn't even acknowledge the letter. And you can be sure that if they were to receive enough of these letters, then they would be seeking guidance from higher level back in UK. So the letter, even if you get what you might consider a fob off, has done the damage. It's the volume of letters that really has the weight. So we're going to say, keep pushing those letters in, and we're delighted to see what responses you're getting from whom.
Okay, now, quick reminder, if you like what the UK Column does and you'd like to support us, your support would be much appreciated. Please head over to ukcolumn.org/community, and there are options for joining us there. Get involved in the community, and as I say, your support would be much appreciated and much needed. Okay, let's move on to the environment. Reducing UK emissions, 2019 progress report to Parliament. This is the Committee on Climate Change, which is an independent statutory body established under the Climate Change Act 2008. They say that their purpose is to advise the UK government and devolved administrations on emissions targets and report to Parliament on progress made in reducing greenhouse gas emissions and preparing for climate change. Now, in July, this report was published, the 2019 progress report. That was all about assessing progress in reducing UK emissions over the past year. And they found that the UK action to curb greenhouse gas emissions is lagging behind what's needed to meet legally binding emissions targets. They said it finds that the action is lagging behind. The government has delivered only one of 25 critical policies needed to get emissions reductions back on track, is what they said. Well, the government responded to this a day or two ago. The report recommended, by the way, that net zero policy is embedded across all levels and departments of government. So net zero policy, that's a key point that we're going to come on to in more detail in a second. Government policies to reduce UK emissions to net zero are business friendly. Oh, right. That's a very important one as well. And there are other recommendations where that the public are fully engaged in the UK's net zero transition and that the UK strongly leads international action to tackle climate change. So if we're surprised that that Extinction Rebellion isn't getting too much pushback from the British government, that they're not considered an extremist organisation, this probably gives us a clue as to why that might be. The key one here is government policies to reduce UK emissions to net zero are business friendly. That's the recommendation to the government. And I wonder, is that recommendation being paid attention to? Well, let's go back to July, I think this was. And this is Mark Carney. And this is what he said at the time. Companies that don't adapt, in other words, they don't meet net zero targets, including companies in the financial system, will go bankrupt without question. That was quite a statement. That was July.
That's a threat, isn't it?
Absolute threat, yes. July 31st, in the Daily Mail, he was giving an interview to the Daily Mail. Well, he was in the Daily Mail again, just a few days. This is August, in fact. Companies will face bankruptcy because of the climate change risk, because of the speed of adjustment. We're going to stress test the UK financial system to see how ready it is for climate change. The country is moving to net zero carbon by 2050. That's a legislative objective, and it's going to require some pretty major changes, is what he said. So this week, or a few days ago, he was in the Guardian again with the same thing. The headline was, "Firms ignoring climate crisis will go bankrupt," says Mark Carney. And he said there will be industry sectors and firms that do very well during this process because they will be part of the solution. But there will also be ones that lag behind and they will be punished. So that, again, seems pretty clear to me. They will be punished. He went on to say, just like in any other major structural change, those banks overexposed to the sunset sectors will suffer accordingly. Some assets will go up, many will go down. The question is whether the transition is smooth or it's something that is delayed and then happens very abruptly. That's an open question. The longer the adjustment is delayed in the real economy, the greater the risk that there's a sharp adjustment. There's a need for action to achieve net zero emissions, but actually it comes at a time when there's a need for big increases in investment globally to accelerate the pace of global growth, to help get global interest rates up, to get us out of the low growth, low interest rate trap we're in. So he said that the City of London is going to be the green finance centre of the world. And he said that certainly the UK financial system is one of the most sophisticated at managing this risk. The UK can extend that lead for the good of the UK, for the good of the world. A number of industrial solutions draw on the strength of UK innovation, from the use of artificial intelligence and energy systems through to potentially advanced materials like graphene. There's a big upside for the UK economy. So that's what he had to say. But where's this all coming from? Well, it's coming from Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures. This is a Bank for International Settlements task force. And basically what Mark Carnage is saying is that all companies are going to have to report to the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures. So the report focuses on the continued progress of companies in disclosing information on climate-related risks and opportunities since the release of the final TCFD recommendations in June 2017. Today's disclosures remain far from the scale that the markets need to channel investment to sustainable and resilient solutions, opportunities and business models. I believe in the power of transparency to spur action on climate change through market forces. Through market forces. But it's not market forces that are being applied here. It's the force of Mark Carney and the central banking system directing the retail banking system to only provide credit to companies that are at work, that are declaring their efforts to move towards net zero carbon emissions. And anybody that doesn't want to do that, or it's not part of their business model, or they can't adjust, or they simply don't believe in this net zero nonsense, they will go bankrupt and they will be punished. David, what are your thoughts on this?
Wow. He's a piece of work, as Mark Carney. He shouldn't use big words we don't like, real economy. I just view a few comments on that. The real is the means by which we coordinate our actions with everybody else in the country and in the world. So if there's a shortage of something, the price goes up because there's lots of people competing for that material. And because of that, people economise and they find other ways of doing things. And everyone then economises and everyone cooperates. It's a beautiful system. It's an elegant system. But it's not what Mark Carney's talking about. Mark Carney's talking about state control. Nominal private ownership.
David, with respect, he's not talking about state control. He's talking about banking control. He's talking about control, which is coming directly from the Bank of International Settlements, which is accountable to nobody. It's worse than state control.
Fair point. Is there a difference between the states and the banks? It's international one world government control, ultimately, Like, what does the Bank of International Settlements do? I've read the book about the Bank of International Settlements. They actually were economically not that bad initially, and it's they wouldn't have countenanced any of this nonsense early in their career. Right. He also, just before we get on to the real horribleness of it, I point out that a system where the state or the government, be it national or international, defines how nominally private owners of assets have to conduct themselves. And if they don't conduct themselves in the appropriate way, they'll lose the assets. That's the economics of fascism, precisely defined. And we have to understand what Mark Carney is advocating. It's an international version of fascism. So that's where he's going. But just before we leave the stupidity, he said low growth, low interest rate trap, right? He's a Keynesian. What's the solution for low growth? It's to lower interest rates, isn't it? This is completely incoherent. Low growth, low interest rate trap, he means that none of the levers he's got connect to anything anymore. And when the next slump comes, there's absolutely nothing he can do. But that's not news. So if we don't buy the complete global warming scam, it's a scam from the start. It's costing the economy, well, who knows how much money. It's everywhere. It's every time you buy anything that's been transported, there's an effect there. Every building that goes up, there's an effect there. It's absolutely everywhere, and it's based on a lie. It's based on error. It's based on mathematical mistakes in the models. And it's based on a determination to make this thing happen so that there is control of people and how they act and how they behave, and that control is centralized. It's opposing any sort of individual freedom or liberty. We will do just fine without their control over every waking thought and every move and every action and every purchase. People will get on just fine without them. We don't need the global warming green nonsense. We don't need Mark Carney.
Absolutely correct. Now, David, where are you at the moment?
I'm in Jerusalem right now.
We've got a couple of Israel-related stories then, and we're going to start with this one. Apparently, access to the afterlife is dependent on joining government in a particular way.
There was a lot of things that were quite strange in the press in Israel when I got over, but I was looking for something that to really illustrate how strange Israeli politics can be and how different it can be. And then beautifully, the Jerusalem Post, 17th of October, came up with this. The spiritual leader of the ultra-Orthodox Shas party, Rabbi Shalom Cohen, has promised Israel Beitenu leader Avigdor Lieberman and blue and white co-chairman Yair Lapid afterlife if they join a coalition with his ultra-Orthodox parties. I guess Beth Lieberman and Lapid know that I do not hate anyone, said Cohen, at a Greet to Meet Your Rabbi event held by Shas in Jerusalem on Tuesday night. I welcome everyone with love. I am certain that you did not intend to anger God, just the politicians. And the proof is that you have not been given the ability to form an evil government. I say here to Lapid and Lieberman, if you now join a government with the ultra-Orthodox parties, you will merit a divine voice that will come forth from heaven and declare Lieberman and Lapid are invited to the world to come. So there you go. If you vote the appropriate way, in Britain, what people are saying, we'll give you tax cuts or more benefits. This is amateur stuff, right? This chap's going to give you eternal life in exchange for a vote. It illustrates just how different some aspects of Israeli politics are. And I thought it was just a nice little note to give people an understanding that it's not entirely like it is back in Britain.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on to Syria then. And a couple of headlines here we've got from Haaretz. U.S. about face in the Middle East forces Israel to reevaluate its defense strategy. They've got the similar article on the online. And also Christian Science Monitor here saying, or reporting, why Trump's withdrawal from Syria has Israel on the edge. Does it have Israel on the edge?
Well, it does, rather. And I picked this up as soon as I came in. The Trump announcement had just been shortly before I arrived here, and it was all over the press. And the tone was close to panic, because the deterrent effect of the Israeli military to deter aggression from the Arab states round about, a big part of that has always been the implication that America will stand behind Israel, will support it militarily. And this has been undercut in part by the American decision to withdraw from active combat roles and what Trump calls, rightly, the endless wars in the Middle East. And this has triggered the paranoia that's present in Israeli society. This has triggered the what Atzmon calls the pre-traumatic stress disorder, that all of a sudden we're going to be on our own. So the Trump decision, although the Trump decision was announced a year ago and then paused because of resistance within the American State Department, that's caused a great deal of soul searching and close to panic in many of the political aspects in Israel. Now, the conclusion has been that they have to look to themselves for their own defense, which was always the case, but even more so. And as they're starting to steady after a week of panic, we're seeing comments along the lines of, well, it's going to mean that there's more action by local players, by local powerful nations like Iran, but also like Israel. There's going to be more scope for action, for military action. So what we can see as America withdraws from the Middle East, the likelihood is that the frequency of conflict will increase.
Okay. Thank you very much for that.
Okay, well, a few words on Lynn Thayer. So we've been reporting, of course, of what's been happening to David Noakes and Lynn Thayer with regard to GC MAF. And Lynn, of course, is being held in a French prison. But I just wanted to put up a very interesting letter that was sent back in August to the MP Gisela Stewart, asking for assistance. Now, it was back in August, and the writer of the letter mentions HM Prison Bronsfeld. Now, Lynn has been extradited and is in France. We'll give you a full address in a minute. But what was interesting in the letter asking Gisela Stewart for help is the person was basically saying they didn't particularly trust their local MP, Dr. Sarah Wollaston. She's a member of parliament and obviously the local MP. She left the Conservative Party to join up with other Remainer MPs on the 9th of December 2014. Hansard, the writer, says she misled Parliament when she rubbished the sources of one of the 150 peer-reviewed scientific papers on GC MAF. The sources are five of Japan's top cancer research institutes, including the Atomic Bomb Institute of Biomedical Sciences of Nagasaki University. So it goes on to say Parliament did not check Dr. Wollaston's. It calls it dishonesty here. Now, that, of course, is open for debate. But the key point is that apparently Dr. Wollaston had in a register of interest that she was receiving money from Flow Ideas Limited, connected to Henry Angst of DuPont Chemicals. And I think the point the person's trying to make here is that MPs were making statements in Parliament while they were themselves connected to the pharmaceutical industry, which, of course, has been working hard to persecute David Noakes and Lynn. This was the letter that came back from Gisela Stewart. I'm sorry to hear about Ms. Thayer's fate. I would, however, ask you to reconsider and contact Sarah Wollaston. As a Conservative MP, whatever party she belongs to, she would be the only one who can raise it with the Home Office. I do have confidence that Sarah will act. Now, of course, this is a fob-off. It's a well-known one because MPs say it doesn't matter whether somebody's been murdered, I'm not allowed to get involved. You have to deal with your constituency MP. And clearly, we can see here she's also not interested in any challenges on the honesty of MPs. But if you noticed on the top of the letter, it's come on Wilton Park paper.
Oh.
And now she is chair of one of the divisions of Wilton Park. But we could ask, well, who is she working for? Parliament and her constituents or Wilton Park? So this letter, just fascinating. And somebody scribbled on it, why is she still a Right Honourable? Question mark. Mm. So we'll put that up again. It's a fob off. But again, this is putting pressure on people. And we hope that people will do more. And just to bring you up to date, Lynn is at this address, Thaya Linda, 452-710-3R08, MAF de Fleury Morogis, 9 Avenue de Poupliere, 91705 Saint-Genevieve-de-Bois, France. But you need to write via the organisation Prisoners Abroad. So address your envelope to Lynn at the address you can see on screen in the French prison, but send your letter to Prisoners Abroad. And if you don't do that, she won't get the communication. Mm. Okay, well, what are we noticing? We're noticing more and more hype warning of the immense threat of Russia. So this is the Telegraph's effort, which I read and really just started to laugh at. We're watching you. Russia accused of sending threatening texts to British troops. And luckily, I couldn't read all of the article, but it was too sad really to do that. UK troops stationed in Estonia have complained of mystery messages appearing on their social media accounts. And officials believe the communications are part of a cyber war designed by Moscow. Was this written by an 11-year-old who'd had too much strong coffee? I don't know. But basically, when you analyse this, this is propaganda. It's fake news. And what is it designed to make people fearful? Now, let's put it against this background, which is this story. You may remember this was back in 2014 when suddenly we were worried because Putin was going to war and we had a submarine lurking around in Swedish waters. And it was all over the British and overseas international media that the Russian submarine was inside Swedish waters. And this was just terrible. So this gentleman, Magnus Nordeman, deputy director of the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security in Washington, D.C., suggests that the presence of a clandestine vessel in the Nordic region would certainly fit with recent Russian practices. You're laughing, Mike, and of course we all should be because this stuff is just appalling. But look at what the Express reported just a few days ago. Russian hidden submarine, real reasons behind Swedish hunt revealed in shock report. The hunt for a Russian submarine in Swedish waters was used as leverage to boost defence spending and reopen the debate on joining NATO, according to a new investigation into the 2014 incident. And if you read this article, there has been huge ructions inside Sweden as the truth has come out that there was never the slightest evidence of a Russian submarine. And in fact, what this was a scam in order to get more money through to the defence budgets. A 100-page final report into the incident took months to complete, and in that time, new defence budgets were signed off by the centre-left government in the meantime. And let's remind ourselves of how the BBC reported. Well, it's tried to debunk the report in a way, but ended it, of course, with lots of material drawing the reader to believing that Russia was connected with this. And if that wasn't enough, they produced a video all about the Russian-Swedish submarine incident. Here it is. Swedish officials say Russian military aircraft frequently infringe the airspace, so they levered from the submarine into other military events. But what they're doing is creating fear. And can we now say the BBC was doing this because it was helping to get the UK public to believe we must be in that EU defence union? Now, the Express were putting across the truth that there never was a Russian submarine there. But what do they do? They litter the article from a few days ago with Sweden hides Navy an underground bunker amid Russian threat fears.
So they're contradicting themselves.
They still won't drop it. They're still putting out the propaganda. I can see David smiling on the monitor. Read more. Russian fighter jet scrambled to escort US and Swedish spy plane. So what we're now seeing blatantly is pure propaganda in the British press. If you want details on the story, I suggest you go to Sputnik, which covers most of the factual information talking about it, where it says that the 2014 chase ended in a bitter fiasco. It resulted in defence allocations and reignited the debate on whether Sweden should abandon the policy of non-alignment and join NATO. And of course, that's what it was. And I think we're allowed to do a little bit of crowing because at the time I was able to speak on Russia Today and I said this incident was complete nonsense. So we're going to say the UK column got in there very early. But where are we now? The Express is on World War III. Soviet Union secret London invasion plan exposed in chilling maps. Is this recent news? No, this is from 2017 because maps like this exist in the West and of course Russia. But even that article was seeded with World War III, secret Home Office doc exposes UK nuclear fears. We haven't finished because the Express also is boasting that there's been a nuclear incident in Russia, 1,000 times lethal dose. We're believing that this is a huge incident. Now, it's a serious incident. But when you get into the article, we find that 5 people were killed and 1 victim reportedly suffered a radiation dose 1,000 times higher than lethal. And if you're thinking, well, it's those nasty Russians, I just encourage you to investigate Broken Arrow. And what you will start to read is all of the disastrous stories of both the United States and the Russians losing nuclear equipment. The US admits to having 32 Broken Arrows worldwide, with 6 nuclear weapons having been lost and never recovered. But we're not reading that in the Express. And what's good about the particular article I've shown you on screen is it refers you back to the State Department papers with the exact figures and reports of the loss of those nuclear weapons. So are they gearing us up to war with the Russians, Mike?
Well, we're certainly going to be bombarded with a lot more propaganda on this. Now, let's just remind ourselves where this type of nonsense comes from. Integrity Initiative, just one of the programs from the Institute for Statecraft, funded by the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. But of course, since the exposure, which once again, the UK column was a key part of the exposure of that, along with a few others, this has been developed and is growing. So we need to be looking at the Open Information Partnership, which calls itself a diverse network of established organisations and individuals across Europe working in open, independent, fact-based reporting. Oh, really? Yes.
For that read propaganda.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's just, Alan Duncan was the minister who made the gave an answer on this. He said that the Foreign and Commonwealth Office's own dedicated counter-disinformation and media development programme aims to protect national security by countering disinformation directed at the UK and its allies from Russia. It funds projects in a number of different countries that seek to enhance independent media, support civil society organisations that expose disinformation and share good practice with partner governments. He went on to say, in particular, we're supporting a new open information partnership of European non-governmental organisations, charities, academics, think tanks and journalists, which are working to respond to manipulated information in the news, social media and across the public space. And of course, this organisation with the usual suspects there, Bellingcat, Atlantic Council, Media Diversity, Zinc Network, supported and funded by the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. And if anybody isn't familiar with the Zinc Network, we showed this back in July or so. This is their website, delightful as it is. and they had won the, or they'd put in the technical proposal for this network of NGOs. If we think that we've seen the levels of propaganda that we've seen and that it's going to stay at that level, we're sorely mistaken, because it is going to be ramped up to a level that we have never seen before. David, very briefly, there's one other thing I want to cover here, but very briefly, you and I did a lot of the work on the UK column coverage of Integrity Initiative and so on. This is only the tip of the iceberg.
Oh, yeah, we're just scratching the surface. And we're going to be, we're going to see more and more attempts to force people to think certain ways. The Russians are the bogeyman. The globe is going to warm up and kill us all. You must surrender all of your liberty to whatever government organization comes along and demands it, because they will keep you from the thing that you have been trained to fear. And the counter view, which is fear not, will be branded fake news.
Well, you don't need to fear, because there's more money going into other areas, related areas. So here we have cyber attacks. Government are going to protect us. How are they going to do that? Well, they're going to be putting money to deal with hostile cyber attacks and online threats like disinformation and cyberbullying through a number of programs. This was announced today by Andrea Leadsom. So they're going to partner with ARM in a new project to develop a new chip technology that is more resistant to cyber threats. It's going to be backed by £36 million of funding. It's also going to be backed by Google and Microsoft. And they're also supporting a new prosperity partnership between Cyber Research Europe, University of Bristol, and GCHQ to develop more resilient wireless networks through new technologies to detect future threats and mitigate their effects. So this is all brilliant stuff. And it doesn't end there, because, of course, the other problem is disinformation. The government's going to protect us from that as well, because they're pumping a further £18 million investment through Strategic Priorities Fund to tackle some of the dangers of the online world. This is going to fit in very nicely with the online harms white paper. It's going to implement some of the solutions that were listed in that. And it's going to set out plans for world-leading legislation to make the UK the safest place in the world to be online. And this project is going to help understand what businesses and individuals need to reduce the harm they're exposed to by using online platforms, and will aim to develop more trustworthy technology. So under those circumstances, David, how could we possibly have any fear? Because the government is there to protect us.
Well, if you don't think, I suppose you can't fear. And what that's suggesting is, don't worry, we're going to eliminate this troublesome need to think. You're not going to have to decide what's right and wrong and weigh up and critically examine different points of view and understand that everyone who's putting a point of view has an agenda, has a worldview, and understand that and understand what they're saying in light of that worldview. No, we don't do that. We have a thing called the truth. It's brought to you by the BBC. And you must not question, because if you question, well, that would be fake news. You can see why they hate Trump so much. When he pointed at CNN and the BBC and said, you're fake news.
Yeah.
That rather destroyed quite a big agenda. And when Trump was elected, and indeed with Brexit, but particularly with Trump, they had all of the mainstream media on board. Everyone was saying Hillary. Everyone was saying Trump would be a disaster. They had every possible media outlet on board. And it still failed, because the internet took a different view, right? They had all the gatekeepers, but it didn't matter because the walls were down. Well, this is them trying to put the walls back up.
Trying, and I suspect they're going to fail.
Well, they must fail. It's our duty to make sure they do fail. But on that image, Mike, with the hoodie civil servants, I didn't pick up whether the hoodies were the civil servants or the hoodies were the hackers. It's a shame that hoodiness has got such a bad reputation, because those Second World War duffel coats had hoods. Were they involved in disinformation?
Could be.
We'll leave it there. David, thank you very much for joining us. There you have it. UK in 2019. Brexit has been achieved, and that's why we are still in the European Union and, of course, still in the EU Defence Union. We'll see you all on Monday at the same time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.